Good day, good morning, good afternoon, depending on where you are joining us from today. On behalf of Copyright Clearance Center, you are very welcome to our program. Is it time to audit your society journal program? And joining us, we have people from across North America and around Europe, from editorial positions, operational positions, people working for societies directly as well as for the publishers who are their partners. And again, you are very welcome. Have you ever heard yourself say, our journal is losing money? I'm not sure if we're operating with industry best practice. We need more staff. If you've asked yourself those kinds of questions or had those kinds of concerns, then an operational audit could be what you need. An operational audit looks at the processes and systems that support the entire journal ecosystem, including the often conflicting expectations of key stakeholders, from authors, reviewers, and editors, to supporting staff, society leadership, and publishing. Our webinar today is going to provide you with some key points around best practices in society publishing. And we all know, particularly here at Copyright Clearance Center, that society journal problems are a strategic element that impact the direction and success of a society. And so hearing about this is going to really have bottom line considerations for you and your program. In the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to take a look at a number of different areas. Change is a part of life, and we'll be looking at the transitions that naturally occur in society publishing. We'll look at how society publishers can review the performance of the journal and the performance of their staff, how they as well can best manage the relationships they have with publishing partners and others. And as Michelle Lawson said, we will take time for your questions. Please use that chat box in the lower right corner of the screen. Let us know what's on your mind. We'll keep questions for the end, but if you have an important and immediate clarification, we'll get to that as well. And now joining me on the line from Washington State in the United States is Kathy Alexander, a consultant in professional and scholarly publishing. And Kathy, welcome to the webinar.
Thank you.
Well, we're delighted to have you join us today, and I think you are particularly someone well-suited to discuss this topic because of your background. You began in society, scholarly publishing, after advising medical and nursing societies on their publishing programs, and you were a managing editor of a subspecialty journal and ended your work before joining the ranks of consultants as executive vice president of professional medical publishing for Lippincott Williams and Wilkins. And Kathy Alexander provides a broad range of services to professional and scholarly societies and associations, including just what we're talking about today, strategic and operational audits, as well as exploring new business opportunities, managing editor-in-chief searches, and serving as a liaison between societies and their publishers. So again, Kathy Alexander, welcome. And let's get started right away by really asking a question, why do an audit? I think it sounds like a great idea, but really it's because when you're working on a society publishing program, there is no triptych. There is no sort of straight-ahead path. We really have to kind of look at things more closely rather than just following a map.
Yes, and it's worse than, very few of us even use maps anymore. Now we're all reliant on GPS. So,
That's true.
And before GPS, when we start down this road, I think that, the journal is the association's face to its members and the greater research community that frequently extends far beyond just the members. And by publishing a scholarly journal, an organization also defines the scope and breadth of the specialized field or the profession overall. But in any case, the journal is frequently the most highly rated member benefit. So it is crucially important to really understand what's going on, whether the journal is published by the society itself or through a contract with commercial publishers. And managing the complexities is really difficult. So when someone contacts me and starts asking questions about their publishing program or the specific journal, they frequently simply don't know if it's operating the way it should. And as a result of that, when they do call and ask me a question, a lot of times they think they know what the problem is, but they don't. And it is the audit that allows us to figure out where the problem really is.
Right. And, you know, that's so important, sort of taking the moment, taking the time to ask the kinds of questions that are important. So often our lives are so busy that we just keep barreling forward. And whether or not we feel that something could be wrong or could be better, we don't take the time to do it. And audits take time. You are an experienced, if we can call you an experienced auditor in this line of work. And so the kinds of examples that we're about to show our audience today are really kind of composites. They're based on the work you've done over a number of years because, frankly, you see the same kinds of problems again and again.
Yes, and all of the examples I'm going to give, they definitely are a combination of many clients over many years. I'm sure there are people listening who will say, "Ooh, I know exactly who she's talking about," and that's not what I've put together. I've really tried to pull out the leading questions that are asked of me or the leading issues that people think they have, and then kind of, you know, mush them all together, because certainly what I do is considered confidential information. I wouldn't want to disclose that. But I'm not surprised at some of the things I'm discovering. Initially I was, but it always takes me down a different path than what I think I'm going to head down.
Right, and what's so interesting, Kathy Alexander, as we've been preparing this program, is to realize that this goes across all types of societies, all types of scholarly disciplines, and all types of arrangements in terms of putting out a journal on a regular basis.
Right.
So this really isn't about medical societies or engineering societies or any one particular field. This is about that activity of publishing.
And the complexities of scholarly publishing.
Absolutely. So let's then get to the heart of the matter, which is, when should I audit my scholarly program, my scholarly journal program? And really, there are a number of moments that you really should at least consider doing so, and you've outlined them for us here. Do people, you know, they don't just sort of do this out of mere curiosity. They see an opportunity that an audit presents to really help them, as you say, understand what the issues are, or for that matter, to find out that what they think is the problem isn't the problem.
Right, and usually and I use the word audit very loosely. It sounds terribly financial, and that's not the way I'm using it. It's just a chance to say, should I really look at what's going on? But I don't have people call me and say, I want you to audit our journal or audit the journal program. What they normally do is call me, and they'll tell me they have a specific problem. And they may, at that point, think they know the answer. But frequently what happens is, when I start digging around, is they've identified a problem, but the answer to that problem may not be what they think. There are so many moving parts and different people involved with journal publishing that I really try not to focus on what – usually it's the executive director who calls me, so not focus on what that person thinks the problem is. Because what I really need to do is to talk to everybody and really get a better understanding from a sort of a 360-degree view before I actually can figure out what's going on.
Well, I think that's an important point. It's a holistic approach, and one that, as you say, it doesn't necessarily look for the fault, but really kind of looks at the entire program and wants to understand what's working, what could work better.
Right. And I try really, I put a lot of energy into not looking for the faults, because
right.
Usually there is more than one fault happening. So I don't want to point my fingers anywhere at the beginning. We certainly can draw conclusions as we go along, but from the beginning, I really feel like we have to look at everything that's going on to identify if there is a problem, and if so, what do we do about it?
Right. You know, finding fault or looking for fault is always a dangerous thing. I'm thinking of a quote from Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa said, "I may have my faults, but being wrong isn't one of them." And I think what's appropriate here is that you're really not looking to lay blame, but to understand what the critical issues are and to help people sort through them. This is a process, as you say, and it's not simply a kind of a single moment in time. And certainly one of those challenges, and again, I'm sure you've heard many times, and when I shared this material with people in copyright clearance, and they said, "Oh, they recognize that," is the following one, which is many people wind up waking up one day and saying to themselves, "Our new editor is crazy. He's some kind of a monster." Does this happen a lot, Kathy?
I love this example because that's a direct quote from the executive director who called me, and she had come from. She had moved. She'd been at the new society for, you know, a year or so, and during that period, they had transitioned from their very established editor-in-chief to a new editor-in-chief. And she called me, and that was her quote: "Our new editor is crazy." And so we talked about some of the problems they were having, and decided that the best thing we could do was a full look at everything that was going on. So in this case, it was very revealing in a lot of ways. This journal is published by a commercial publisher. The staff never has in, I shouldn't say of course, but normally the staff of a society does not have a lot of input into the selection of a new editor-in-chief. So they had been working with a fellow who had been in the been the editor-in-chief for 10 years. He was slow. There was a backlog. The authors were complaining. They hired a new, young, very innovative editor-in-chief. And he had so many ideas that I mean, he was just like a fountain of things that he wanted to accomplish. And the staff members were accustomed to a very, very slow pace. They didn't have anyone who was devoted full-time to the journal. It was sort of a half-time person here and a half-time person there within the organization. And here, this fellow walked in, and he had high expectations of what he wanted to do and how he was going to be supported. So first I listened to the staff, and we had, and they came with examples, printed out examples of all his craziness. And then I listened to the editor-in-chief, who was very open and very justified, I felt, in his frustration, just as the staff was frustrated because they didn't know what to do with him. But what came of all the evaluation is that the staff really was stonewalling. They didn't like him. They didn't like that he was creating more work for them. They preferred the leisurely pace of the former editor. And so we clearly had a tremendous conflict going on. So I kept meeting with the editor and with the staff members to really try to dig in and see everything that was going on. And then I called the publisher and talked to the publisher about their perspective of what was happening. And they finally, after a few conversations, admitted that, yeah, this was kind of a difficult situation, that the editor-in-chief had very strong feelings about the way things were supposed to be done. So they were constantly adjusting their processes to meet his expectations.
Right, and you know,
so
Kathy,
I did this whole, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I think you're sort of leading us to how you approached arriving at a solution, but I just want to pause a moment to consider, because one of the things you do is manage editor-in-chief searches, so this is probably not a very uncommon instance, and it particularly is an example that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So the intention here was to bring in some new blood, kind of reinvigorate a program, sort of, you know, become more innovative, become more dynamic. It was just the way that it was handled was the issue. It wasn't the intentions. It was the way it played out.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And when I started talking to the publisher, like I say, and the publisher was still trying to be enormously supportive of this society and this new editor, what the publisher and I figured out is that this editor had never been what I call onboarded. So he stepped in, started working, started taking over, and he took over so much stuff that he wasn't supposed to do that it was just, I've never seen an editor who felt like he should be doing this this kind of work. And so I arranged for a meeting with the staff, with the publisher, with the society. And prior to the meeting with the editor, bringing him in, I went to the publisher and I said, you have to stop. They were going ahead and doing things completely out of the way they normally work because they thought that was what the editor wanted. And the editor didn't know there were any other ways to do it. And so he and I had dinner the night before we had this onboarding meeting, and I said, told him at that point, I said, there's nothing that you're doing that is normal or within standard processes. And he was shocked, and he sat back and looked at me, and he said, well, what am I supposed to do in this meeting? And I said, just listen. And so we had a wonderful full-day meeting with the publisher, and the publisher kept saying, this is the way we need to be doing things. And he would look at me and say, do you mean that I am not responsible for doing that part? I would say no, and he would just say, oh my God, I just got 3 hours back of my life. So to me, the whole reason I use this as an example is the editor wasn't crazy at all. The staff was annoyed, but understandably. The publisher was trying to do their job without creating a problem. But the real solution was that no one had done an official bring this editor to the table with the staff and say, let's talk about how we work together for everyone's benefit.
Yeah.
So what we did is we had the onboarding. We outsourced peer review because the part-time staff internally really couldn't handle it. The journal has grown and is absolutely thriving under his leadership and was just voted as the number one member benefit for the society. It's known for fast review time, fast publication time, and yet the editor continues to be challenging. He's a little crazy, but they can deal with it now because the rest of the stuff works. So now they have to figure out, okay, then how do we assist him going forward with his constant want, need, and desire to change.
Well, it's kind of like Frankenstein in the movie. He's just a lonely guy if you really try
there
to understand
him.
There's a question, Kathy, a clarification that I think is probably worth getting to right at the moment before we go on to the next example. And Kathy Jo is asking about who the EIC reports to. So this is not a staff member per se. This is someone working for whom precisely?
Yes, and I think that's a very excellent question, and it's also a complex question. Frequently, the editor-in-chief reports to the leadership of the society, and that can be pretty clean. Where I am seeing increasing issues, however, is when you have and I'll talk just to medicine for a minute because this particular case is medicine. When you, the leadership of the society they're not physicians, and then you have a physician leadership as well. So in this case, the editor-in-chief, if he doesn't get what he wants from the society, he goes to the physician leadership and convinces them that he should get what he wants, and then the physician leadership goes to the leadership of the society itself. So in this case, it's an awkward situation, and I don't think that's terribly unusual when you start talking about leadership of societies themselves. There's certainly much more connection between if you're dealing with a physician editor-in-chief and physician elected officials for the society as opposed to who actually makes the society run on a daily basis.
Right. It sounds like it really requires some political skills. And let's move on to the next example, which likewise has, I think, it's fair to say, a kind of a political aspect to it. And that's the question, just whose journal is it anyway? And this is about editorial independence. And so what's at stake here? It's really about responsibility for the journal program at a very high level. And sometimes this can be contentious.
Yes, this is relatively new that I'm sort of consistently running into, and I think it was much easier when we lived in the time of only print distribution of journals. So, if you look at a journal contract today, or excuse me, not a journal contract, but an editor-in-chief contract, it's very clean about editorial independence. I mean, there's no question that a society can't tell a publisher what to publish. That's pretty clean, and it's a real flashpoint for society-owned journals. Most of the leaders of society-owned journals are very clear that they can't step into that space of saying you can't publish that article or we want you to publish this article. The editor-in-chief is definitely the arbiter of what content is suitable. Where I'm really seeing some complexity, however, is if you have a creative editor, and this editor is particularly enamored with all things online, that he or she, in this case, is wanting to take the journal and build out new online elements to the journal or features, functionality, things like that, without any discussion with the society. So I've seen one situation where the editor wants to develop a new piece of the journal, has gone very far down the road with the idea of doing this, and it's an online element. And when I heard about it and I was talking to the executive director of the society, I said, this is what so-and-so is wanting to do. And she goes, whoa, wait a minute. We are doing something within the society exactly the same thing. And they are not talking to each other about it at all. So I get in the middle. I felt like a shuttle diplomat recently, where I was literally at a meeting and I'd go and have one meeting with the editor and then go from that meeting and have a meeting with the executive director to try and bring this conflicting ideas together. The editor feels very strongly it should be part of the journal. The executive director is concerned about it conflicting with the society is building for its membership. But it gets into business issues as well, because the publisher is willing to do this additional element for the journal, but the editor never gave any thought to the fact that it's going to increase the budget for the journal that requires the support for the new element. So staff time is going to be increased. They're probably going to have to hire another part-time person to help with this. So both of them think they're right. And I think that I'm going to, when I'm working on editor-in-chief contracts in the future, try to start introducing some language that discusses the need to collaborate with the owning society and involving putting together essentially a business plan if you're talking about developing something new. Because at this point, it is very vague and in this particular case is becoming quite contentious.
Right. And what's interesting about that, I think, Kathy Alexander, is that so that wall that you were talking about early on, it served a function in the past, but we have reached a point, particularly in the digital world, where I guess Kathy Alexander tear down that wall. Isn't that part of what you're saying, that that the wall existed for editorial purposes, but for strategic reasons, for financial reasons, there needs to be more collaboration?
I think so, and you know, there's one example that some people may be aware of where there was a new editor who came in with a medical society. The journal was known for being a clinical journal, which most of the members of the society were. The editor was very well received, went through all the interviews, and then after he was named editor, informed the leadership that he was turning the journal into the highest impact factor journal in the specialty, and therefore was changing the focus of the journal from a clinical journal to a research journal. That is editorial independence at its best or worst, I guess.
Right, best or worst.
But there's nothing they could do at that point.
Yeah. Well, an interesting example, and another one that may be less obviously a problem, which is a complaint you heard once that the editor-in-chief is a data geek, and in a world of big data, that sounds like that could be a good thing. But why was this a problem? How was the editor-in-chief behaving?
Okay. This, to me, goes to not just the fact that the editor, what it revealed was something more than this data geek. The editor-in-chief insisted, because he was a computer whiz, on he wanted to analyze everything. He wanted to reanalyze the impact factor. He wanted to analyze the work of the reviewers. He wanted to provide his own analysis of the section editors. And his leadership, in this case, all comrades of his, in the sense of they were all professionals. This was not the executive leadership of the society. They all bought into it because they loved listening to him talk and loved all the pretty pictures he was showing them. So I was asked to come in and take a look at what was going on. And what we found out was his interpretation really masked a lot of problems that were going on with the journal. No way of knowing this is intentional or not, but it is certainly what the issue turned out to be. So, for example, he was touting the fast review time and showing these terrific charts. But if you looked at what was really going on, because of the way the charts were put together, it masked the fact that, yes, there were many of the articles that went through a very fast peer review, but when you dissected the data, what was really happening is a lot of articles were getting immediately rejected. There were many articles that were going through extremely lengthy peer reviews. But because of the way he would present the data, and you look at average and go, oh, well, that's pretty quick. But then when you dug into it, you realized that it was not quick at all, because he had been rejecting papers outright and then including those in the average. The number of research papers being submitted actually was decreasing for this journal. But again, he had developed a way of reporting on submissions and kept adding new categories into those submissions. So if you looked at the total number, which was what he presented, this is how many papers I'm getting each year, what was happening is the number of research papers was actually going down, but other new elements, for example, blog posts, were suddenly included in that total, again, not showing what truly was happening with the journal. And then the one thing that was really challenging was looking at the author surveys and actually reading what the author surveys said, which were in several many cases very scathing because of the length of time for review, the fact that they were getting conflicting advice from reviewers, or that they were going through 3, 4, and 5 revisions and reviews. So I advocate very strongly that there should be someone who is very, very familiar with the journal, who is really looking at what's going on. This editor would argue me until we were both blue in the face about his interpretation. but the reality was much different than what he had been presenting. Well, so, honestly, you know, when I talk about who's minding the store, I really do feel that there needs to be someone within the organization, whether it's a managing editor or whoever, who is in working in the journal and with the peer review to really make sure that the information being presented to the leadership is accurate.
Right. You know, it just makes you think, Kathy Alexander, that on the editorial side, people are familiar with having a second set of eyes review a manuscript before it gets published. It's something that they should apply as well to presentations and to reports.
I think so. But, right. You know, this went on for a long period of time, and editors have a tremendous amount of power.
And certainly people respect that, and that kind of power is one that is also sometimes challenging for executive directors when they come on board. And you had one who was very honest with you and said, you know, I'm the new executive director around here, but what do I know about scholarly journals? How did that happen, and what did you do to help work with them to address the challenge?
Well, I don't think it is that unusual, quite honestly. I mean, I've worked with several executive directors who have not had experience with scholarly publishing. If they come from a large organization, they might have had a publishing director who completely, you know, took over all responsibility, so they really didn't have to get in there and know the details. When you're talking about someone coming into a smaller organization, there might not be a publishing director. You might not need one. You may be working with a commercial publishing house where there's just been a ongoing relationship, and it's run fine and nobody has really dug in and queried things. So, I mean, I try to identify for these people the critical issues. You know, certainly the clarifying the business models. We are no longer selling print subscriptions. This is an electronic licensing world that we live in, and just getting a hold of that. Because a lot of people will step in and they'll go, oh, well, we sell subscriptions. And it's like, no, that's not it at all anymore. The thing about editorial independence, I have found that to be an increasingly important element that an executive director needs to understand. And there are, just like we've been talking about, a lot of nuances in there. So, you know, we get into some pretty direct conversations about, no, you can't do that. No, you can't say that to your editor-in-chief. That is stepping right on the issues around editorial independence. Evaluating the processes, I think that where I have run into the most interesting, a couple of situations, one published with a publishing house, one is self-published, is that a lot of times what's happening is we're all cutting back. Everyone's cutting back. And there's not the money there used to be to send your staff to meetings to make sure that your journal people are being educated in what's going on. How do you know if you've got current practices that are the best practices if you never get to go to a meeting? And so you end up with staffing issues that frequently just keep growing, you know, in the sense of, well, the only thing we can do is bring on more people. And that's not always the situation. More and more material is being outsourced, or more and more jobs are being outsourced. That certainly goes to peer review, for example, and sometimes that's the best option. So the staffing needs and looking at the staffing needs become very important. I just finished a project with one group where they had some staff that all they did was rewrite manuscripts. these were two different self-publishing societies, where literally their time to publication was extraordinarily lengthy because the staff felt that they needed to go through two or three versions of the manuscript after it had been accepted for publication to clean up the language. And when I queried them about that, you know, their feeling is, well, every single one of these words has to be just absolutely perfect. And so the staff, because they don't get out and look around, were becoming very isolated in the way that they were approaching their work. And so it's that kind of information that I need to feed the executive director to make sure that they understand you can't just operate in a little bubble. You have to be able to keep your staff up to speed, and don't identify staffing needs before you really understand what they're doing and how they're doing it. And then journal performance overall, it's just really important to make sure that you know what are the key elements that you should be looking at. And it's so interesting to me that frequently what I'll find is that they have done huge amounts of research in the sense of author surveys, reviewer surveys, sometimes with consultants, sometimes not with consultants, and then they very nicely stack them up and put them in a corner and they never act on anything. So assessing journal performance is just step one. Moving on that is step two.
Right. Well, you know, I think one of the points that seems to be coming through as a theme in this discussion, Kathy Alexander, is the importance of facing change, recognizing the change is happening, encouraging people to become comfortable with it, kind of, you know, the need to get out and to perhaps see how things are done in other journals or with other societies and so forth, and kind of learn what the kind of best practices are across the industry. Those are sort of obvious but yet essential tips, because I'm sure for a lot of these societies, change, while it's there in life, it has not happened so often. But one of the changes that probably are happening, or changes that is happening so much more often today, is a kind of a generational change and a move to new editors-in-chief. And we've talked about what happens when the new editor may turn out to be something of a monster, but there's a way to prevent that, and it's to really make the transition for the staff and for the editor as comfortable, as collaborative and communicative as possible. Talk about how, you know, what are the best practices to make that happen?
Okay. Well, first of all, we hope always for a collegial transfer of power, but that's not always the case. And something that's very hard to plan for. Most of the transitions are very friendly between the incoming and the outgoing editor-in-chief, but that is not always the case, and that's a tough one to plan for. So we have to plan for what should happen and what we hope will prevent any problems. So clarifying the time frame very early on for both the incoming and the outgoing editors is extraordinarily important, and it needs to be put in writing, and there needs to be details. And you, as much as possible, want everyone to agree. So you realize that if the new editor is going to inherit any kind of a backlog, that new editor will not have any impact on content until that backlog is published out. So really looking at how many papers are sitting there waiting that will be in the backlog that is transferred to the new editor, I think, is extremely important. And make sure that you have agreement and understanding from both the incoming and the outgoing editors. And constantly checking in to make sure we're both on the same page. If the editorial board structure is changing, and the new editor-in-chief is bringing in his own people, there has to be a plan to let the existing editorial board know And, you know, in an ideal world, the sitting or the current editor-in-chief will do this in the sense of saying, okay, you know, we all are coming to the end of our terms here. And it's like when, you know, when we elect a new president, everyone is supposed to put in their official resignations. I'm not saying that it has to be that drastic, but there has to be an understanding that things are going to change, and that's okay from the existing editor-in-chief. A new editor-in-chief really needs a lot of guidance and support, and some are more willing to take this. Others are enormously opinionated in this regard. But I suggest always enlisting the publisher to host an official onboarding meeting for the new editor-in-chief. And if he's bringing in a deputy editor or section editors, to have a meeting where you clarify every process that goes on from peer review to publishing to marketing to talking about what is considered standard in today's world, because it continues to change. And a lot of times incoming editors in chief don't know the questions to ask. So yes, you may err on the side of you might go a little overboard in some editor's mind, but I'd rather go overboard than have them going off on a tangent thinking they need to be working one way when we really do want to work a different way. So looking at the processes, you know, instructions to authors, which will change under a new editor conceivably. What's the workflow? What are the responsibilities of all the people that are involved? And, you know, making sure that you have taken any data you have on ongoing author surveys that you can share with the incoming editor and say, okay, here's the problem we've identified. How do you want to address this? So that person can say, okay, I want to do things a little differently. But the whole thing is about developing a collaborative relationship between the society leadership and the editor-in-chief.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I mean, I think finally the last point there is one that, I mean, this isn't some kind of Google car that drives itself. You've got to agree on goals and to really assess them on a regular basis, which again seems like best practice in so much of business today, but maybe something that societies haven't done in the past. They may have, as I say, kind of let things drive themselves, and it's best for both sides to sort of check in at least on an annual basis, you're suggesting.
I think so, and it's a little touchy because, you know, you get into that how dare you evaluate what I'm doing as the editor. But I think it's really important. The editor is responsible for the journal. He's the steward of the journal. And what he can do, what he does, can make or break the journal, quite honestly. I think what's problematic is when an editor doesn't feel that he can have an honest conversation with the society leadership to say, you know, we're having some problems here, or this is an area where I'm concerned. And the journal can go off track pretty quickly, you know, as far as whether it's losing authors or the financials, you're losing licenses, you know, there's all kinds of things that can happen. Yeah. And I don't think that having a conversation with the owners of the journal means that you've lost your editorial independence.
Right.
I think it's important for those conversations to go on.
Absolutely. And while one of the ways that journals can get off track is sort of bumpy relationships with editors-in-chief, the other relationship that's so critical, and if it gets off track can really create real problems, is the relationship that societies have with commercial publishers. And obviously quite a lot of the societies do that, and they must have very high expectations of these publishers. What happens when the publisher isn't meeting those expectations?
First of all, I think every society should know who within their society manages that relationship, because that's enormously variable. So I have clients where the editor-in-chief is the primary contact for the society, which I think is problematic. It may be the executive director if it's a smaller society, because they might not have staff devoted to the journal within the society. If the journal is big enough to warrant a managing editor within the society, then the managing editor may do it. But it's all over the place, and I think that that is a really important thing that I discuss if I'm working with a, particularly if I'm working with a self-publishing society who transfers to a commercial relationship, is to make sure that it's very clear going in who's going to be the key owner of the relationship. I think that having the editor-in-chief as the dominant relationship holder can be problematic. First of all, the editor-in-chief, they come and go in a period of time, but then that sort of starts to mix in the idea that the editor-in-chief is responsible for the business, which I think is a real conflict for the editor-in-chief. So actually thinking about this is enormously important. The thing that I wanted to talk about here was if something isn't working and you're with a commercial publisher, or something isn't being done to your expectations, what do you do? And of course, what I hear is a lot of people grumbling. You know, they'll grumble at me about, well, the publisher didn't do this or they didn't do that, but they don't call the publisher and say, we need to have a talk, I'm not happy. And I want to go to something that this actually also comes up with self-publishing societies, but it's just an example for this particular thing we're talking about. A lot of times I'll hear the editorial staff is clamoring for more help, and they'll say they can't keep up with the volume of manuscripts being submitted. And earlier I mentioned the need for editing, extensive editing, and this is not an uncommon situation where you're working with a publishing house, you don't like what they're doing. You don't like their copy editing. You say they're making too many mistakes. And what you do, instead of calling up the publisher and say, we're not happy with this, we want you to fix it, slowly but surely, the society staff starts taking back responsibility for doing things like copy editing, checking references, things that they have convinced themselves that the publisher is incapable of doing right in their regard, and so they start doing it themselves. And then suddenly you get into the situation where you have staff saying, we have too much work, we need to hire more people. I have always found that the best thing to do, and the thing I encourage people to do when you run into that, is you don't start doing it yourself. You have a serious face-to-face discussion about what the problem is. Put that problem back on the publisher's list and let them solve it. If they can't solve it, you have a different situation. But you are in an arrangement with a publisher because you expect the publisher to provide certain services.
So, in other words, I don't know
that the publisher is going to clamor to get it back, but that is certainly your right as someone who's published by a commercial publishing house.
Right. So for me, what that sounds like, Kathy, is there's no point in holding grudges here. You need to articulate a problem when and where you see it, and expect there to be a professional conversation about it. As you say, after all, there's a financial relationship here that the society has with the commercial publisher, and in any other business relationship, you would expect to raise problems and have them taken care of. And the same is true for this one.
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say that, I've gone through this quite a few times, and sometimes it takes a little longer than you hope, but it gets fixed. And if it can't be fixed, that's a whole nother discussion.
Right. Well,
if you just sit around and complain and just keep taking back more and more work, that's not good management of your relationship. And so that goes back to relationship management overall.
Right. Be assertive.
And the last thing I wanted to say, and I know there's some publishers on the phone, and so they will groan at this, but there are times when you don't have a good match with the publisher who is personally responsible for your journal. The contract is between the society and the publishing house. And then the publishing house decides who they will assign to your account as your personal publisher or account manager, whatever they're calling it, you know, in whatever company you're working with. If you have concerns about the person who you're working with most directly, it is certainly well within your rights to have a discussion about that. And I know it's difficult and it can be unpleasant for a society to confront this, but I think it's really important that if you're unhappy with your publisher or you feel your publisher is not doing the job you need done for that journal, that you speak up. So that means going to that person's supervisor, which is hard. This is your business we're talking about.
Indeed, it's very critical to the society, and as you say, this is your business. You should bring it up. So be assertive. Kathy Alexander, thanks so much. We'll get back to you in just a moment with questions from the audience. We have a couple of interesting questions, and some interesting points have been made. And we have Barbara sort of thanking us for this because it's a conversation starter that she is hoping to have at her journal. And I want to actually bring on a colleague of mine from Copyright Clearance Center who's been sitting with me throughout the presentation, and that is Rebecca McLeod, who is Strategic Account Manager here at Copyright Clearance Center. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Kathy, that was a great presentation. And my background actually is in journals publishing. So when I look at hearing all these issues, I'm kind of speaking from the perspective of a publisher. And just one thing to underscore your point about the importance of a strong connection between the publisher and the society. You know, that has to go beyond the editor-in-chief. I know from my experience, we worked with a society that the editor-in-chief would rotate and change every 2 years. So, you know, we had to have those face-to-face meetings and understand as a publisher what the society's business goals are, not just the editorial goals or the strategic plan if they had one, and be able to support all those plans. So that would go beyond the traditional publishing portion of the business, but could be, you know, help support the society in terms of maybe perhaps membership fees or something like that. So, you know, at CCC, we hear a lot about that, those issues from publishers, and we do have solutions for them.
Right, indeed. So there's the whole notion of handling membership fees, is the challenge of open access. That's one of the solutions that we have been offering into the marketplace recently, a whole variety of particularly author-focused services, Rebecca.
Yes. So our RightsLink for Open Access platform allows societies and publishers to work with societies to kind of manage that, all those APCs and membership fees. And I think that, again, that helps cement that relationship with the society that goes beyond just the editorial experience and the peer review.
Right. Well, we do have some questions from the audience, and let's try to get to a couple of them. You know, Kathy, we were talking about societies having high expectations of publishers, and somebody wants to know, well, what if those expectations are unrealistic? That's a fair point.
And I think that, you know, the society has an unrealistic expectation of a publisher. Is that was the question, not the other way around?
Right, exactly. You mean, you know, expectations are high on both sides, but what if one side has things kind of set the bar unrealistically high?
Yeah, and I think that is not unusual. I do believe, though, that the whole business about, first of all, you'd have to go back to when you signed the contract, what did you really promise as a publisher to the society? But there has to be honest discussion, and that's hard if you don't have a relationship at the highest levels with the leadership of the society and the leadership of the publisher. I think we're going to see more and more of these difficult discussions go on. It is clear that things are flattening again in sales, and when things flatten, there's less money to be spent and fewer people to put on to certain accounts. And I think there are going to be some hard conversations that go on in the next few years.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure those conversations are taking place, unfortunately, for many people listening to us. You know, we do have a question hear from, believe it's John. John is asking about his work at a small society that has two publications but has never had a publications committee, and the society is now realizing that they may need one. What kind of advice do you have in that particular instance? And the caveat here is that in the past, the editor has had almost no oversight.
So I would say, first of all, we need to make sure that we have a real clear definition of what that committee will be accountable and responsible for. Is the editor going to report to that committee? If so, what does that mean? What has the editor been doing in the past that he would no longer be responsible for? And to make sure that when that committee is established, it's not to be perceived as some sort of taking away of power or a slap on the wrist to the editor. That's not it at all. It's just that in this environment, I think that we need more people involved rather than fewer people involved. The complexities of publishing today, whether you are with a house or not, when you start thinking about plagiarism and peer review and, retractions, all the things that we're all looking at, this is not a one-man band anymore. It really does need support. So on your committee side, though, you have to make sure you're getting people who are actually interested and want to be informed. To have a committee that thinks it's just a committee for the sake of saying yay or nay to something isn't the answer.
Well, Kathy Alexander, we have a lot of questions, but we have come to the end of the hour. We've got people looking for some share, asking you to share resources around onboarding processes. We may need to have you come back and join us again, but we have been very happy to have you as part of our webinar program today. I want to thank Kathy Alexander, a consultant in professional and scholarly publishing. Pleasure having you on the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
And we'll take just a quick moment to tell you about a couple of upcoming Copyright Clearance Center appearances at the upcoming Book Expo America next week. There is a co-occurring conference sponsored by the International Digital Publishing Forum working with SSP. And on Tuesday, May 10th, at 3:30 in the afternoon, Michael Healy, my colleague in the International Relations Group here at Copyright Clearance Center, will give a global update on the state of copyright. The following day, on the 11th in the morning at 9:50, I'll be speaking about text and data mining for a program called Move Over Humans, Machines Want to Learn. And I'm guessing many of you will be joining us in Vancouver beginning of June for the annual meeting of the Society for Scholarly Publishing. And at that event, Copyright Clearance Center is holding a very special cocktail reception at the Weston Bay Shore. I expect many of you will be getting an invitation about that, but that takes place on Wednesday, June 1st, from 8:15 to 10 p.m. Our booth at the SSP show in Vancouver is 208A, and we certainly hope you'll stop by and say hello. And then finally, the ongoing webinar series from Copyright Clearance Center continues. This will take place on June 8th, I believe. On June 8th, Copyright Clearance Center works with Wiley to give you the latest results on their annual Wiley membership survey, and you'll learn what they've learned and what you need to know. Wiley surveys over 13,000 researchers every year, and the results make fascinating sort of intel on the direction the business is taking place, and particularly, why those highly engaged members in your society look to you because they want to make a difference. So join us for that on June 8th. And for all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, for my colleague Michelle Lawson, who's gotten us through the webinar with great style, thank you all for joining us. My name's Chris Keneally. Have a great day.